Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Greetings, Merry Christmas, and hello. This is the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, Head Tree Trimmer at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, where we are wrapping up year number 29 of celebrating Christmas together online. This episode of the Merry Little Podcast is brought to you by Merry Christmas Radio, your home to classics and oldies of Christmas, many of which we're sure, well, maybe you've never heard before, music that is all Christmas, all commercial free, and all from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Tune in now at MerryChristmasRadio.com. If you would have told me a month ago when we began this series that we'd get five episodes out of this topic, I think I would have told you that you were nuts. Well, we're not stopping at five episodes because we can't. In this, the fifth episode, you're going to feel some Christmas spirit, but we're also going to shock you a bit. That wasn't our intent in taking up the microphone again, but it happens sometimes as we research more deeply into the stuff of Christmas as we go along. We learn new things. Honestly, these episodes can all be blamed on two facts. First was the fact that we had bits and pieces of some of the information of the Victorian time frame just sitting around waiting to be shared, and, well, I guess it just kind of piled up. But also, I would say that the more we dug into the media archives of the 19th century, the bigger it all became. A different picture of the Victorian era of Christmas has emerged, and that's kind of where this episode is going to go. So we're going to shake the tree a bit, and maybe an angel or two is going to fall off of it. While we have focused so far on a lot of history and background and people, places and events, such as the Civil War, in our exploration of the Victorian Christmas, we move on now to the things that most people think they are familiar with from this time frame. Namely, well, the stuff of Christmas, things like decorations, food, and fashions from the time period. We're going to get to all of that. But first, let's shake that tree, shall we?
Christmas is a-coming, and the cider's in the keg. If I had a mug of cider, then I wouldn't have to beg. If you haven't got a mug of cider, half a mug'll do. If you haven't got a half a mug, may God bless you.
God bless you, gentlemen, God bless you. If you haven't got a half a mug, may God bless you.
If you haven't got a thing for me,
may God bless you.
We begin this episode with a bombshell, something I'm sure that will get me in a lot of trouble. Well, criticized at least, that's trouble for me. But I have to let this out, so prepare to be shocked. You see, I've concluded that Queen Victoria actually had nothing to do with the Victorian Christmas. Absolutely nothing. Nada. Zip. Zilch. It's a lie. It's 19th century fake news. It's a media fabrication and an utter failure of historians. Perhaps the biggest that I've seen in my research of Christmas over, well, 30 years now. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't a Victorian era of Christmas. I'm saying that Queen Victoria just had nothing to do with it. Now, in the previous episodes, we explained a plenty about the Christmas history with British royals and how Victoria celebrated Christmas as a child. Her marriage to Prince Albert didn't suddenly introduce Christmas trees and the German Christmas to the House of Windsor. That had already been a thing for well over 100 years, both in the House of Windsor and in the UK. We've also explained how generations of German immigrants brought their Christmas traditions to America in the 18th century, and that most of them had trees. We know that Christmas trees were a public spectacle in Boston of the 1830s when a famous abolitionist society held a fundraiser for children that featured a Christmas tree, an event that received widespread media attention. We've shared that the Christmas tree lots were set up in large cities such as New York and Philadelphia as early as 1842. But the official narrative that you read just about everywhere, whether it is in books or online or in museums, is that Christmas trees did not become a fad of Christmas in the 19th century until Queen Victoria and family were featured in 1848 with an image that was ultimately shared in all kinds of publications. And I went with that. It's believable given the fact that she's a royal and one in a position to wield widespread influence. In fact, the twisted tale of how Victoria rose to the throne in England is some history you just have to read. She was never supposed to be the queen, but after a series of scandalous events, there she was at age 18, 19, going from princess to queen. She was actually fifth in line, and somehow she made it to the top, an event that really wasn't anticipated when she was growing up. Her ascension became a worldwide story, and her coronation became really one of the very first worldwide covered media events in contemporary news. And it was huge news in America. It was so big in the city of Philadelphia that the city became engulfed in all things Victoria. One news writer quipped, "We now call this Victoriadelphia." Well, I became suspicious, even bothered, when I saw one more bit of evidence of Christmas trees in American newspapers long before the so-called picture of Queen Victoria and family from 1848. It came when I stumbled upon the publication of the story of the Little Match Girl by Hans Christian Andersen in an Ohio newspaper in 1847. I didn't know that it dated from that time period, so I looked up its history. The story was written by Andersen in his native country of Denmark in 1845. It became a sensation first in Europe before it found its way to America in 1847. I did a search, and I found it in no less than 70 newspapers in the spring of 1847. His story was different than, say, Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol. That was written in 1843 and was such a runaway success that it found its way to America by Christmas of 1844. It was in every newspaper that year too, but not as a published story like Andersen's was. It was just advertised for sale and was reviewed here and there by critics in major market newspapers. I thought that curious and wondered why the story of the Little Match Girl, which really isn't all that long at around 800 words, why was that story offered for free in newspapers but not for sale as part of a book? Why would a writer do that, right? Well, it turns out that Andersen was something of a new writer in 1845, and that's just the way it worked. But I was bothered by something else about the whole thing. You do know the story of the Little Match Girl, right? The story is about a little girl who, on a bitterly cold night, is afraid to return home after not selling any of her matchsticks on a terrible cold wintry day. She feared her father would beat her because they were so very poor. She found a place between two houses and huddled there thinking of what to do and decided she would burn just one match to warm herself up a little bit. The little match burned hot and did give her a little relief for as long as it lasted, and she stared into the flame and she dreamt of happier thoughts, such as of a beloved grandmother or a happy event in front of a Christmas tree. A Christmas tree. Printed in a story, coast to coast in America in 1847, long before the so-called Queen Victoria picture. Pretty interesting, right? But here again was proof of the Christmas tree in America before Victoria. And it gave me questions. Decorating for Christmas was an ancient practice, especially amongst Christians in England. This song, titled The Holly and the Ivy, is rich with Christian symbolism. The sharpness of the leaves helped to recall the crown of thorns worn by Jesus. The red berries serve as a reminder of the drops of blood that were shed for salvation. And the shape of the leaves, which resemble flames, can serve to reveal God's burning love for his people. Holly and ivy commonly appear together as mainstays of Christmas decor. Some say the holly represents the Christ child, and the ivy represents his mother Mary. Others find symbolic meaning in the fact that these plants do not die in winter. In the evergreen leaves of the holly and the ivy, they are reminded of the promise of everlasting life embodied in a newborn babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. Now the song itself, hundreds of years old, speaks of the tradition of decorating and using items of symbolism to give deeper meaning to the season. Music such as this throws us back to why our traditions of Christmas first began, and clearly the very idea of Christmas decorating was British. What led me to Hans Christian Andersen was actually a search I was doing about the import of glass German ornaments, and I thought they were a post-Civil War kind of thing, but as I searched the dates, kept going backwards. And did you know that glass imported ornaments for sale in the United States actually dates back as early as the 1840s? Now, I'm not saying they were everywhere, but they were at least as far west as Ohio, because I found them in an ad on the same page where I just happened to notice where the Little Match Girl was printed in 1847. Now, folks, if they had glass ornaments for sale in 1847, guess what? They had Christmas trees. Now, I'm not saying Christmas trees were yet in every home, but I will say that I possess enough newspaper reports and journals now from the 1840s and 1850s to contend that Christmas trees were no big secret in America. People knew about them, and many people had them. There are scores and scores of what I call reaction stories, the times when people made a record of seeing the Christmas tree for the first time, and most of these date from the 1840s and the early 1850s. So this all begs the question, what's up with the Queen Victoria thing? I mean, the famous picture we see in all the books and all the websites that credit her and Prince Albert for the Christmas tradition is one we've all seen, right? But did you know there are actually two pictures? The original ran in publications in London in 1848. That image was picked up and then modified by an American publication called Godey's Ladies Book, a popular women's magazine that was edited by Sarah Josepha Hale. Do you remember that name from our last episode? She was the lady who dogged American presidents for 15 years to recognize Thanksgiving as a holiday. It was Hale who was responsible for the image of Victoria in Godey's Ladies Book. You see, Hale was a huge Victoria fan. She felt that as the queen, Victoria was a leader among women, and for the years that Hale was in charge of publications, she featured Victoria on the pages of her magazine. But before the image was published, Hale had some modifications made to it. She wanted the family in the picture in front of the Christmas tree to look more American. So, in a 19th century effort, not unlike photoshopping an image today, she had Victoria's tiara removed and shaved off the mustache from Prince Albert's face, as well as dressed him in something more akin to American male fashion of the time. This is the image that we see in all the books, a doctored image of a family in front of a Christmas tree, not a royal family, an American family. Well, was Godey's Ladies Book that big of a thing? I say no. When Hale took over the magazine, it had a circulation of 10,000 subscribers. What year was that? 1837. Oh, and what year did Victoria assume the throne? 1838. And what city was Godey's published in? Philadelphia. Victoriadelphia. What happened to Godey's subscription rate as a result of their coverage of Victoria? Well, it went through the roof. growing to 40,000 by 1840 and expanding yearly until 1860, where it peaked at 150,000 subscriptions. The famous altered picture of Victoria and family did not appear in the magazine until 1850. So it is safe to say that less than 100,000 copies of it was printed in a magazine in a country of 23 million people in 1850. You see where I'm going with this? Godey's, for as good as it was, and for as popular as it was in no way big enough to make everyone put a Christmas tree in their home every Christmas Eve, especially when it is clear that the trend for in-home trees really started in the 1840s, long before the image ever appeared in the magazine. If Christmas trees were already a thing, and stuff like ornaments were sold in stores each Christmas, then all Victoria's picture could have done was to throw fuel on an already burning fire. Now, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I want you, however, to question the Queen's role in this time frame called the Victorian era. Queen Victoria's reach was worldwide. Up until Albert died, she was very visible and very vocal and very opinionated and very influential in just about everything she touched. The way she dressed, the things she said, the stuff she and Albert did were all a matter of public record, and they did set trends in nearly everything that they did. But I'm telling you no about this Christmas tree thing. They were not trendsetters. They were bandwagoners, at least in the media. Godey's was just too small a publication to have that kind of influence. And here's the kicker. The American newspapers of the 1840s to about the 1860s never had much to say about Victoria and Albert's Christmas. The famous Godey's feature about their Christmas tree wasn't mentioned anywhere in the newspapers. Not a one of them picked it up. If it was so influential, don't you think it would have been brought up sometime? Well, there was some other coverage of Victoria in the newspapers. I did find this from 1844 in New York, long before the so-called famous picture. Quote, "Last evening, three imitation fir trees in green stands and upwards of 8 feet in height were placed in the drawing room at Windsor Castle, each beautifully ornamented with 72 wax lights appended to the branches. One of the trees was entirely frosted over to resemble icicles in snow. To the branches of each were suspended an immense quantity of bonbons contained in small boxes in cases of various devices, richly and elaborately ornamented. One of these trees was for Her Majesty, another was for the Prince Consort, and another for Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Kent, who I believe was Victoria's mother. But not a word about bonbons for the prince and princesses, their children. Bonbons for Her Majesty, bonbons for Prince Albert, bonbons for Papa, Mama, and even for Her Royal Highness, Grandmama. But none were for the royal little ones." Clearly, when it came to Victoria, Godey and Sarah Hale were big fans. But the American media? Maybe not so much. The Christmas tree picture never made it to American newspapers, as I said. So what are we to make of Queen Victoria, of whom the Victorian era is named? I think, for me, that Victoria is merely a figurehead, someone recognized for being there, but not for doing much for Christmas during that time. Her name was on the sleigh, so to speak, but she wasn't driving it.
Thinking back on my best Christmas day, I see snow-covered fields of red Georgia clay, and my grandmother there was hardened and gruff, 'cause she never had more than just enough. I remember hearing her say, "There's work to be done even on Christmas Day. There's no time or money for ribbons and wreaths, for trimming a house with a Christmas tree. We hung shotgun shells on a little scrub pine, red and green and brass that would shine. They still decorate my memory. Shotgun shells on a Christmas tree." Well, my dad just ignored my grandma's decree. He took me hunting for a Christmas tree. There in the field with the rabbits and squirrels were more shotgun shells than I'd seen in the world. We crunched through the snow to a place he knew well. While he picked out a tree, I was picking up shells. I could already see them there in my mind, tied to the tree with pieces of twine. Shotgun shells on a little scrub pine, red and green and brass that was shine. They still decorate my memory. Shotgun shells on a Christmas tree. Had a tree for the very first time, a Christmas red clay North Georgia pine. And even my grandmother came in to help, and we strung it with 4 10 and 12 gauge shells. I'd never seen such a smile on her face as she laughed as we set out the table places. About what a sight it was to see. Shotgun shells on a Christmas tree. We hung shotgun shells on a little scrub pine, red and green and brass that would shine. They still decorate my memory. Shotgun shells on a Christmas tree. We hung shotgun shells on a little scrub pine, red and green and brass that would shine. They still decorate my memory. Shotgun shells on a Christmas tree.
I go back now to our research of Christmas ornaments, and here's another thing that I learned. First, it was far easier to find out about ornaments from the 1840s and 1850s than there was to find out about Victoria and her Christmas, both in the UK and in the US. There are, remaining today in museums and collections all over the world, plenty of surviving ornaments of the Victorian era. But what I've noticed is that the vintage stuff of England is far different from the vintage stuff of America. Now, this needs more research, and maybe we can find a vintage expert out there to help us. But what I saw was that British ornaments of the 1850s and 60s were indeed more ornate. They featured complex details such as birds and figures of important people posed in different settings. And they would put these on the tree. They had ornaments that were made with lace and beads and all manner of colors used in these elaborate, mostly handmade ornaments of the time. America's ornaments, on the other hand, were more rugged. In many cases, they were as simple as stars made from tin with holes punched in them to allow light to leak through where placed on the tree. If there were ornaments of people-shaped objects, they were made of cloth in a rag doll kind of style, or perhaps even crocheted, and many of them were angels in America. Other ornaments of the time were shiny glass ornaments that were purchased in an American store but were imported from Germany. In other words, Victoria may have had her influence, but I think it was more in England, and it was among their upper crust, their higher classes, and it reflected in the ornaments we see of England of that time that are in museums and collections today. America was influenced by other things. The popular works of the time, the merchants of Main Street, and the public Christmas trees that communities and churches put together, that's what the papers clearly show. That was where the real popularity of Christmas trees in America stemmed from. They were public spectacles, whether it was at an abolitionist society meeting in Boston or a first public Christmas party in Salt Lake City. Over and over and over in the newspapers from the 1840s and 1850s, there are results to be found coast to coast of public Christmas trees in town squares, on town stages, and in churches already decked with holly and evergreens. Victoria, really, had nothing to do with it at all. And that makes the story, oddly, of the Victorian Christmas in America and all the stuff of it all the more interesting and unique.
As the snowflakes dance across the lawn, the wind begins to blow. The holiday music greets the dawn for the songs we all know. I'm warm and cozy in my bed, dreaming of Christmases through the years. Grandma's memory in my head, I remember what she whispered in my ear. Son, I want you to have something to remember me by. And handed me a green Christmas ornament that made me wonder why. It was Grandma's Christmas pickle, like a warty green icicle. She thought it was better than a new bicycle. It was Granny's old Christmas pickle. Some have thought it might be obscene, this dilly of an ornament in glorious green. And though it's not kosher and fashion is fickle, we all relish Granny's Christmas pickle. So as you hang your lights in shiny balls, we'll always heed the briny holiday call. 'Cause we know Granny's spirit is lurking, as we proudly hang high her holiday gherkin. Yeah, Grandma's Christmas pickle, like a warty green icicle. She thought it was better than a new bicycle. Yeah, nutty old Granny's Christmas pickle. Yeah, nutty old Granny's Christmas pickle.
We'll begin our exploration of American Christmas stuff with a little story about the Christmas pickle. It's a story of the now and the then. It's a great story to lead out with because it contains elements of truth and fiction, and it showcases neatly how storytelling and selling and the wink and a smile way of doing Christmas business ends up creating traditions and legends. As we shared with you in our episode from a while back about Christmas ornaments, this story begins smack in the middle of the Victorian era at Woolworths. In the 1880s, the old Woolworth retail store started selling glass ornaments in the shape of various fruits and vegetables. That's throwback, actually, to the European Christmas tradition of nativity plays. Think Adam and the apple. Fruit was used symbolically to teach the story of Adam and Eve, and then later the birth of Christ. For many, even during the Victorian era, decorating a tree included this tradition for some because the Christian practice of telling gospel stories could be easily accomplished and because, well, fruit was simply available. Woolworth, of course, didn't think the glass ornaments from Germany that a salesman pushed at him would sell. And why would he think that? Well, they didn't do anything, in his opinion. Now, as an old retailer, I'll tell you exactly why Woolworth was wrong. He wasn't thinking of women who made most of the buys in his stores for things like Christmas decorations. Women saw the fruit-shaped glass ornaments, and they snapped them up. They were colorful. In some cases, they were shiny, and they were extremely cheap. And they liked all the fruit and vegetable-shaped ornaments, except for one, the green glass pickle ornaments. Perhaps that seemed like a dumb thing to put on a Christmas tree at that time. I don't know. Well, the story supposedly goes that, faced with this huge inventory of unsold glass pickles, an enterprising sales clerk made up a story claiming that the ornament represented a very old German tradition. A real pickle, in Germany, evidently, was always hidden somewhere on the family Christmas tree, and the first child to find the pickle got an extra present, or got to open their presents first. Well, Woolworth customers in New York City, many of them immigrants from Europe, fell in love with the fabricated story and bought all the pickle ornaments that they could find. Some of them bought them and then sent them back to their families in Germany, proudly telling them that they can now use a glass pickle on their tree instead of a real one. The American glass pickles became sort of a status symbol in Germany, and soon everybody in the motherland wanted the Woolworth ornaments. Today, more glass pickle ornaments are found in Germany than in the USA, some say. In fact, the story of the Christmas pickle is more of an American tradition instead of the ornament itself. There are various versions of this story floating around, and several places lay claim to being the birthplace of the Christmas pickle tradition. Such is the stuff of Christmas.
At the North Pole to spend a holiday. I called on dear old Santa Claus to see what I could see. He took me to his workshop and told his plans to me. So you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, checking it twice, gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been good or bad, so be good for goodness sake. Oh, you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why, Santa Claus is coming to town.
The song you just heard is the first and original recording of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, written by Haven Gillespie and released in 1934. What does that have to do with the Victorian Christmas? Well, Gillespie was born in 1888 into a family of nine children. They were a very poor family, as you can imagine. But can you imagine what Christmas was like in their home in the 1880s? Some of the lyrics of this song give us a clue. With little tin horns and little toy drums, rooty toot toots and rummy tum tums, Santa Claus is coming to town. I know you've heard this many times. What Gillespie is describing are ads from the merchants of the 19th century who set up shop for Christmas, likely right where he lived. These are exactly the kinds of things they advertised as Christmas gifts for children during the Victorian Christmas. I think these days that we would call those stocking stuffers, and for the early part of the Victorian Christmas, that's exactly what Christmas was for most children, a Christmas stocking filled with surprises. Decorating a Christmas tree for most folks was more of a happy home industry, something that people did on their own, which brings me to another story. One of the original things we offered on our early website back in the mid-1990s was stories of Christmas memories, and we have saved every one of them, and they remain available online today. It was about 20 years or so ago that I was contacted by a lady who wanted to share a most unusual story of Christmas and family history. It's archived on our site under the title Angel Twin. This lady, who said that she was in her teens when this happened, could recall an ornament that her mother would bring out last of all to put on their family Christmas tree. Even back then, it was clear that the ornament was very old, dating back to a different time in Christmas altogether. After many years of seeing her mother bring out the old box that held this frail and ancient ornament, she finally asked her mother about it. Now let me read part of this story to you. Quote, "I got her from my mother, who had it when I was a girl," Mother began. "She was on every tree we had when I grew up, and just as she has been here every year for you. When I was 14, I asked my mother just what you asked me just now, and that's when she told me the story. Grams got her when she was 18, and that was when she asked the magic question of her mother. Astonished, I began to see this ornament already in a completely different light. I knew it was special to my mother, and always had been, but she never volunteered the story before. I did not know that I had to ask to learn the secrets of the ornament angel. How old is she?" I asked. "Where did she come from? Who made her, and why?" Mom smiled. Her eyes sparkled. This was clearly a moment that she looked forward to for a long time. "This angel was made by your great-great-great-great-grandmother, Christina, in the 1860s. It has been placed on the same special spot on every Christmas tree in our family every Christmas since that time." Mother still held the little angel ornament in the box, the tissue paper open. I touched my mother's arm and looked inside at her. She was completely barren of any kind of holiday color or sparkle. She was made with a simple stitch, and knowing now how old she was, I imagine that at one time her real color must have been pure white. Christina was 9 years old when she learned the real reason Christmas was not celebrated in their home. She was born on Christmas Day, and they always celebrated her birthday, but never did they celebrate Christmas. Christina asked her mother why there was no celebration of Christmas, and her mother explained to her that when Christina was born, she had a twin sister who was stillborn. It was a sad and a happy time in their home, and Christmas always reminded them of the heartbreak of that day. By celebrating just Christina's birthday, they avoided reliving the pain of losing the other baby. Christina was so saddened to learn that she had a sister who was lost, but in her young girlish mind, she did not see her sister as a dead baby. She instead saw her as an angel. And angels were what brought the good news of Christmas to the shepherds, so it would not be bad to remember her. On her own, she made the angel ornament and gave it to her mother for Christmas that year. She explained that the angel represented her dead sister, who would watch over Christmas as a happy time in their family from that time forward. Christina made her parents promise from that day forward they would celebrate Christmas, and they always did. Now, that story was likely my first lesson in the real Victorian Christmas. It represents how folks viewed Christmas in the 1860s and how they decorated for it, which was by hand. Christmas trees were not only a brilliant custom that people were still getting used to, they represented a new way to express themselves and a way they could literally customize the Christmas celebration in their home. And that was the very trendy tradition in those days, the Christmas tree. Of course, all real trees at this time were lighted with tapered candles, and they were in the home for only a short period of time. Customarily, they were brought into the home and decorated on Christmas Eve. In fact, I was able to get my hand on several stories that talked about fathers bringing home Christmas trees and getting them set up either on a table or on the floor. Then, the tree was decorated. In many cases, the tree stayed up until the day after Christmas. For some, the tree was a 12 days of Christmas thing, not coming down until January 6th. The Christmas tree merely augmented what was already a huge tradition of family gathering and celebration together. By today's standards, those trees probably look pretty plain, but they were hugely important. Two elements, the Christmas tree and the Christmas stocking, occupied the final preparations for the typical family Christmas. The stocking, of course, was for the children, who looked high and low for the largest stocking they could find, or begged their parents to buy supersized stockings at a store. This is a childhood memory for many, many children in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. They spoke of it fondly. A newspaper of the time told stories of outfitting the children with their stockings as a task that fell to the father or the grandfather in the home. And it was a tradition that most men loved. But it was the Christmas tree that held the fancy for the women. Nearly every tree was custom decorated because decorations you could purchase just were not yet a widespread thing prior to the Civil War. Bigger cities had some, but not a lot. Like every custom of Christmas, the decorating of a tree was, well, evolutionary. And you can see that in the advertisements of merchants in the UK that imported decorations from Germany. And they were a thing there in the 1830s and 40s, and not until a decade or two later, the 1840s and 50s in America. They advertised beads and reflectors, balls, and even birds of bright colors as Christmas tree decorations. Such decorations, as I said, didn't really become available until a little while later in the United States. There's some evidence that some were available commercially. In an 1859 edition of the New York Daily Herald, they reported on a Christmas program at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church, which featured a tall Christmas tree hung with flags, shining Christmas balls, and wax candles of every color. Presents were literally strapped on somehow to the tree, and they had to be cut from the tree in order to be given to the kids one by one. And this, according to the report, was the highlight of the entire program at the church. It really wasn't until sometime during the Civil War that we start to see advertisements for Christmas ornaments available for purchase in major markets. In an edition of the Buffalo Daily Republic, we found an ad for a store called Barnum's offering Christmas ornaments for sale. And they were labeled as balls for Christmas trees. The New York Times, during the war for the first time, featured ads from Henry Millard's store where among his Christmas wares were, quote, fancy ornaments for Christmas trees, unquote. The same in Philadelphia at Martin and Quayle's stationery store and Fancy Goods Emporium, I love that, where they offered ornaments for trees described as fairies, fruit, and birds. As the growing trend of Christmas trees in regular homes grew, so did the industry of homemade decorations expand. For many, decorating began by firing up the oven. Food, you see, was central to nearly everything Christmas during the Victorian era.
Got a holiday hunger and you want to be fed. Put all thoughts aside and get a piece of that pumpkin pie. Ever since I can remember, it's my boyhood dream. A thin brown crust and a scoop of whipped cream. You just can't try to stay away from that pumpkin pie. Don't wanna wait until the relatives come over. I don't wanna wait until the ball game's over. I don't wanna try to wait for my pumpkin pie. A pumpkin pie makes a fireplace so nice. You can tell a lot about a man by the size of his slice. That's right. Forget all about your New Year's diet. Though you resist, I know you gotta try. You just can't try to keep yourself away from that pumpkin pie.
It was about this time, middle of August, 2 years ago, when the most popular episode of the Merry Little Podcast was recorded. We titled it Pumpkin Love, and it was all about the surprising discovery of pumpkin as a traditional element of the American Christmas, dating back to the days of Puritans and Pilgrims. It is by far our most downloaded episode, and it is by far the most popular episode during every month of the year except for November and December. As we went down rabbit hole after rabbit hole in researching the Victorian Christmas, an effort that has now given us these five episodes, it was not my intention to go back to the topic of pumpkin. After all, we've covered that, right? Well, wrong. Just as pumpkin is a thing for modern-day Christmas podcasts, it was also a thing in the Victorian era. I kid you not. Now, why do I continue to be surprised by this? Honestly, I've found enough stuff on pumpkin alone that I could share with you to make its own episode on the Victorian Christmas. Now, I won't go there, but I'll just squeeze in some of the best stuff here. I found, quite by accident, that the love of pumpkin did not wane at all with the arrival of the 19th century. In fact, its legend and love seemed to grow during the Victorian Christmas. Now, to understand and appreciate what I'm talking about, if you haven't heard that episode titled Pumpkin Love, stop the music right now and go listen to it. It's well worth your time. I promise that it is. The 17th and 18th century Christmas was full enough with the stuff, but the 19th century was the time when it seems that the diversity of pumpkin products really began. Now, in our day, we're still silly with the stuff. We don't even make products with pure pumpkin anymore here in the 21st century, but we still call things pumpkin and people go crazy for it. I mean, what exactly is pumpkin spice? Does anyone know? The pumpkin has such a mild flavor, I doubt if a spice could actually be made from it. Yet we have dozens of products labeled as pumpkin spice flavored, from coffee to Jell-O. I even saw a pumpkin spice face mask the other day, and I'm not even joking. Someone's going to be making money off of that this year. And looking over the newspapers of the 19th century, it's very obvious that pumpkin was one of the premier traditions of Christmas. Still, there were recipes everywhere, and no matter if I pulled a recipe from 1810 or 1890, it was like going to Taco Bell. Everything was made with the same seven ingredients. Pumpkin pie, pumpkin bread, pumpkin pudding, pumpkin ale. It was all made with pumpkin, sugar, nutmeg, brandy, eggs, and cinnamon. But better than the ingredients that were put into pumpkin pie and other things, were the stories. I found this gem of a story from a newspaper of 1868 about Ulysses S. Grant, who was, by 1868, the President of the United States. Grant was a brigadier general commanding an expedition against rebels in Arkansas, a company of advance scouts being commanded by a man named Lieutenant Wickfield were on a 110-mile march and had only a few provisions. So, being hungry, when they came upon a small farmhouse, they demanded food of the people that were there. But the people in the house were suspicious and reluctant, so Lieutenant Wickfield said that he was actually General Grant. Well, that got their attention, and they did their best to produce a meal with the finest stuff that they had available. Wickfield, when he and his men were through, wanted to pay for the meal, but wanting to show their loyalty, the family of the farmhouse refused, so they went on their way. Well, as luck would have it, the real General Grant came upon the same house a short time later, and he too asked if they could cook him some food. Well, they refused, saying that General Grant and his staff had just been there, and they had eaten everything in the house except for one pumpkin pie. Having inquired the name of the good lady who gave him this information, Grant induced her by $0.50 to promise to keep the pie until he should send for it. Well, that evening a grand parade was ordered and the troops were formed up 10 columns deep and a quarter mile long. Officers were called to the front and the following order was read. Lieutenant Wickfield of the Indiana Cavalry, having on this day eaten everything at Mrs. Selfridge's house except for one pumpkin pie, is hereby ordered to return with an escort of 100 cavalry and eat that pie also. U.S. Grant, Brigadier General, commanding. So at 7 o'clock that evening, amid cheers of the army, the lieutenant and 100 men filed out of camp, and in the course of the night duly returned, and with all due formality, well, that pie was eaten. If you go back and listen to the Pumpkin Love episode, you will hear plenty of passionate poetry about pumpkin. We found more of the same in the 19th century, a lot more. Now, we've shared a lot of great poetry with you from our exploration here of the 19th century Christmas, from Longfellow to Poe to Dickens, but what you're about to hear is proof positive of how pumpkin can make you spew with passion and wreck any skills you might have with poetry. Quote, "Hello, my good friends. Just give me your hand. While I tell you the best production of our land, you will be astonished and say, 'Shoo fly,' when I tell you the best thing to eat is pumpkin pie. How easily 'tis eaten by the old ones that gum, and the wee ones greedily say, 'Ma, I want some.' So in order to shop their loud, or to stop rather, their loud howling cry, Ma slashes out each a piece of pumpkin pie. The children are willing to come home on the run at 12 from their school instead of staying for fun. How joyous they are. Their feet fairly fly. They know very well they will have pumpkin pie. Jolly fun we can have in the fall of the year, cutting pumpkins and rings, placing on poles in a tier, and then let them hang until they are quite dry. Then they are ready at times for pumpkin pie. There is Brother Fillmore, whom we call Uncle Cy, I think can do justice to a pumpkin pie. He's larger than myself, though not quite so high, but in much better shape for a fat pumpkin pie. One more verse, and I'm not telling a lie. The best half is eggs of a good pumpkin pie. When I'm done on earth and just ready to die, the song I would hear is pumpkin pie, pumpkin pie." One question that we keep getting over and over from the Pumpkin Love episode about pumpkin is, why was it that big of a deal? After all, just how much pumpkin pie can one eat? Well, it's important to remember that in the agrarian society of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, they really did live sustainably. One pumpkin seed could be planted and yield a vine that could produce 80 other pumpkins. Plus, they didn't have to devote special space for it. It was most common for them to plant pumpkins literally within their corn. So pumpkin was cheap and very easy to grow. And they told stories in the news of pumpkin vines growing as much as 4 inches in a single day and 2 inches at night during the heat of summer. But pumpkin wasn't just for human consumption. It was fed in a variety of ways to all kinds of livestock, and to their great benefit. The circle of life on early American farms was a solid model, one ripe, if you pardon the pun, for growing a nation. With the 100-day growing window and the ability to store for a long time, pumpkin was an ideal ingredient for nearly all of their holiday merrymaking. And of course, there were some other foods, but none that generated the love and the passion and the poetry of pumpkin. There was gingerbread, eggnog, and cookies of all types, all homemade, all prevalent, from October through February, and all in their own special ways associated especially with Christmas. And that's where we go in the next episode, the 6th of the Victorian Christmas. Can you believe it? Join us at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, our year-round community of Christmas cheer, where all are welcome, as long as you bring pumpkin pie. For MyMerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.